Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me, Linda Bordoni, on the English program. And of course, very, very best wishes for a happy and peaceful new year. Meanwhile, here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI reflects on the Mother of God and on her special mission in the history of salvation. A traditional New Year's Eve celebration for the poor and the homeless of the city shines the light on the sad predicament of many, day in and day out. And Father Jim Brand thanks God that all of us, whether we are saints or sinners, are called to love. Pope Benedict XVI held his weekly general audience today in the Paul VI Hall here in the Vatican. Some 7,000 people from all over the world were there to greet him, to listen to him, and to wish him a Happy New Year. Amongst them, there were many English speakers.
Most Holy Father, the English-speaking visitors and pilgrims are happy to have this occasion to express to Your Holiness their sentiments of deep respect and esteem, and to assure you of their prayers for your ministry as the successor of Peter. They also offer you their prayers and best wishes for a happy and blessed new year.
And during his address to them, the Pope reflected on the importance of the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God, whose feast the Church celebrated on New Year's Day.
Dear brothers and sisters, at the beginning of this new year, I offer prayerful good wishes to all of you and your families. Yesterday, the Church joyfully celebrated the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God. This ancient title of Our Lady, Theotokos, reflects the truth that Jesus, her Son, is true God and true man. The confirmation of this title at the Council of Ephesus in the 5th century led to ever greater devotion to Mary and the dedication of numerous churches in her honor, including the Basilica of St. Mary Major here in Rome. During this Christmas season, we can sense a close relationship between the Incarnation and Our Lady's dignity as the Mother of God. Indeed, the title Mother of God expresses Mary's special mission in the history of salvation and her particular role in the mystery of Christ and the Church. Our Lady's Divine Motherhood is in fact the basis of every other title by which the Church honors her. Mother of God and Mother of the Church, Mary was also entrusted by Christ to be the mother of each of his disciples. In this new year, may we turn to her with confidence, and through her protection and prayers be strengthened in our love for Jesus, her Son, and our service to the coming of his kingdom.
And after his catechesis, Pope Benedict returned the greetings and good wishes to those present in the Paul VI Hall in several languages, including English.
I greet the English-speaking visitors present to those audience, especially those from Ireland and the United States. I especially greet the various pilgrimages of priests and seminarians and the many student groups in your midst. I also thank the choirs for the praise of God in song. May the new year bring God's richest blessings to you and your families.
And as always, the Pope ended the audience with the recitation of the Lord's Prayer, and with a blessing that goes out to you all.
Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
It has become a steadfast tradition here in Rome to hold a big New Year's Eve dinner for the poor and for the homeless, a group of whom this year was also entertained by the New Orleans Gospel Choir. This tradition of solidarity is due above all to the goodwill and to the good work of the St. Egidio community, a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelization and charity. In conjunction with a music foundation, 350 poor Romans were invited to partake in a joyous meal of lasagne, meatloaf, spinach flan and dessert. And the doors of the city's beautiful auditorium were flung open to many who would have otherwise spent the evening hungry and lonely. And while initiatives such as this give us all a warm and happy feeling inside, the effects of New Year's Eve are soon over, and still, hundreds of thousands of people, every day, don't even know where their next meal is coming from. And the more we see people looking in rubbish bins in search of something to eat, the more we must realize that food, or the lack of it, is one of the most serious poverty problems of so many of our neighbors, right here, even in Europe's richest cities. And Rome is no exception. The vertiginous rise in the cost of living and the hundreds of thousands of penniless migrants and refugees in search of a better life are the main reasons there are more and more people out there on our streets every day with an empty stomach. I've often thought of signing up as a volunteer at a soup kitchen. It's a simple thing that anyone can do, but I never have. I have, however, met someone who has done just that. He's Benedictine monk Timothy Wright. And when he's not globetrotting for the work he does for interreligious dialogue, he's off to the soup kitchen at Sant'Egidio here in Rome.
First of all, I was invited by one of the sisters here who goes every week. And I thought, I've always, wherever I've been, I've always wanted to do something which was to help poor people, to help the disadvantaged, whatever way it was. And this seemed to be an obvious thing. Friday afternoon, go down to the Sant'Egidio in Trastevere and to work. And I didn't know what to expect, but sister said, come on, so off I went.
The community of Sant'Egidio, by the way, is a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelization and charity. Since its beginning in 1988, the soup kitchen has given hospitality to more than 100,000 people and has served 2,200,000 meals.
And you turn up and we arrive at buses permitting at about 4:10, and we have 45 minutes to set the room up, which means getting the table set up, chairs down, tables, places laid for the two rooms, each of which will take about 100 people. Then around about 4:45, the doors opening at 5:00, the other volunteers will start to arrive who are going to help out on the tables. And they're coming from largely from the religious houses. In the session that I do, they come from the religious houses in Rome, nuns, sisters, seminarians, priests, superiors, lay people, men and women. It's a wonderful mix of people, and you gradually get to know them. 5:00, the people come in, the men and women come in, mainly men, but there are a few women who come. Having gone through a process of registration and questioning and help by the Sant'Egidio community.
I was curious to hear exactly what goes on.
Basically, they come in, they sit down, and it's slightly complicated because the meal operates on a system whereby there are two courses. So when one person sits at your table, whoever it is, you immediately go and serve them. You don't wait till the table fills up. And the person will sit down and you go, primo secondo, which means, do you want the pasta and do you want the main course? To which the answer usually is, yes, primo secondo. So you go over to the serving area, you pick up a basket with two pieces of bread in it, a piece of fruit, and then you go and collect a plate of pasta and a piece of, which can be meat and vegetables, or something like that. And you take it to them and you give it to them. And that is the meal that they have. They may ask for soup in place of pasta, or they may ask for formaggio, which is a block of cheese, instead of the secondo, or any permutation of the various options. And they come in regularly, and they're coming from a huge variety of backgrounds.
Father Timothy told me that the attention to the dignity and to the personality of everybody is expressed in the care of the environment and in the courteous attitude of the volunteers serving at the table. And he said, particular attention is paid to the meal that considers the eating habits of the guests with respect to their religious tradition. For example, in consideration of the presence of Muslims, pork or wine are never served.
What struck me immediately was I thought, well, the homeless people in Rome, when I first arrived, being quite ignorant, I thought, well, the homeless people in Rome won't be such a big problem. Rome's a nice city. The Catholic Church is pretty active, should be getting its act together. Examples of the world. Well, I was amazed, A, the number of poor people you find around Rome.
A lot of old people, aren't there?
A lot of old people, but also some very handicapped people. I've seen people going around on skateboards because they've got no feet. And I often, myself being not an expert here in Rome, will ask the question, you know, well, why can't we do something more for them? And there is one answer, which is there is quite a lot that goes on, and it's a question of going to the right place. Anyway, when they come into Sant'Egidio, and these are young people, older people, and people who have been coming for years, people who know the system, and live a wandering life. And some of them, you can tell, are very relaxed when they come in. They look at you, you greet them, and when you get to know them, you chat a bit, and they recognise you. Others, you come in and they're much more, obviously, recently here, worried about their future, worried about what's happening. Come and sit down, you say, prima secundo, yes, fine. And you give them what they want, you smile with them, welcome them, etc. But it's, you sense that there's a distance there and there's an anxiety. Others, you sit down, once you start talking, you suddenly discover that, like me, not very fluent in Italian, and so they prefer to speak English. And they will come from countries in Africa, Eritrea. I've had one or two from Ethiopia, and I met one or two from Sierra Leone and other parts of Africa. And you can get into quite for a little, because it's quite a busy time. You can't have a long conversation, but you can have a little bit of a conversation.
I can imagine that a lot of them might want to talk. I mean, a lot of them must be very lonely.
I think so, but on the other hand, you do get the impression that a number of them are quite friendly to each other. They come in sort of groups and they sit down. And I would imagine, though, that a lot of them are probably... I mean, this is what I don't know, but once you arrive and you've got nowhere to go and the whole question of whether you're legal or not legal, that's an issue which I'm not an expert in. But if you are not quite got the right papers yet, it must be quite a lonely business. And I think the Sant'Egidio community are doing their best to try and help people in order to facilitate that sort of thing.
Do you see people who maybe have led quite an ordinary life? I mean, they've always been poor, but they've managed to survive. And now maybe they're old and their pensions don't cover expenses. Yeah. And they find themselves in the predicament of having to go to a soup kitchen. Do you find people like that?
I think
can it happen to anyone?
It can happen to anyone. And some of the people you look at, you say to yourself, because they look a very different sort of person, and perhaps they're coming because, as you say, they've fallen out, they haven't got enough money, they've lost their money, they're coming to get a meal. Because the soup kitchen, I think, only operates Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays. And so they're providing a good meal three times a week. And it may be that that's enough to give them the bridge between not having anything at all, having just enough, and to sustain them for the other 3 days. But you do get... some people you see coming through, not that I've had any chance to talk to them, but you say, yes, well, you feel like saying, well, you probably had a wonderful life before and something has happened. And that's, I find that always very difficult and very sad.
That's something I learnt a few years ago when I did a series of programmes on street people. It can happen to anyone. It's so easy to fall through the cracks of society and find oneself on the edge, marginalised, lonely, and even hungry.
It must be very sad. job. Should we call it a job? No, it's not really a job, but it must be a sad, in a way, thing to do.
What the great gift of this, and I was talking in terms of gift, is that it makes me aware that there are a lot of people in our world who live lives as simple, as deprived as the people who come into the soup kitchen. And it makes one ask a lot of questions about the way we construct our system to help. And as I said earlier, I've travelled a little bit in various countries of the world, and everywhere you find that there is always the very small group who are phenomenally well off, a middle group who are okay, and then a bottom group who, you know, who are there because they can't get out of it. And at the end of the day, if the economy of the country is strong enough to give them jobs, a lot of them will get jobs and can go up the ladder. If it's not strong enough, they end up forming this group of people who, of course, you know, have a resentment, that they're not welcomed, they've been pushed out of their own country for survival. The people who migrate out of a country, we always have to remember, are always the more talented, because they're the ones who've got the get up and go and say, well, I've had enough of this, I'm going. And we'll cross mountains and take boats across seas and all this sort of thing. And the illegal immigrant, to use a phrase that is often spoken of, are the people who have got the energy, who have got the gifts, and have got the vision to say, I can't do any worse here. It's better for me to go. Now, in most countries, those people eventually will find a footstep and make their way up. But the people who, for one reason or another, don't get the right steps on the ladder, they often fall back to the bottom. And they're the people who so often are left behind.
And that's why he does it. Father Timothy told me it's not only to help these people and give them a sense there's some material help, but also to give them a sense of being worthy and valuable and lovable as they are. And now for one of my favourite moments, Father Jim Brand, spiritual director at the Pontifical Beda College here in Rome, reflects on how wonderful it is that all of us, both saints and sinners, are called to love.
Hello, it's Father Jim again. I've been making some noises about the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is that faithful, eternal, unshakable, unbreakable unity and love of the Father and the Son. And that same Spirit is offered to us. We're invited to join in that divine family as sons and daughters. And so faithful, heroic love is our calling. Whether we have friends, whether we're married, whether we're families, as far as we can, to be committed to someone, I think, is just as important as being committed to everyone. Because everyone doesn't exist, they're only individuals. We can only love people in general if we love some people in particular, I think. And the real love can be very sacrificial. It's generous. It's long-suffering. It's like our Lord with his friends. And they were weak. Now, this is a poem about a highwayman. I don't know whether he said stand and deliver and robbed coaches. The area around Heathrow Airport in London, I believe, used to be notorious for highwaymen. There was a sort of heath there. You more or less took a few guards with you if you travelled along that patch. Often they got hanged, you know, Dick Turpin and everyone. But whether we're saints or sinners, thank goodness, me a sinner priest, I'm glad that even we are called to love. So this is a poem by Alfred Noyes, which was dinned into me as a young child, learnt by rote rather than by heart. And I remember, I think I did win a prize once in an elocution competition. For me, this is a very sad story, but a heroic one, about a sinner highwayman who loved. It's by Alfred Noyes, The Highwayman. The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. The highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He'd a French cocked hat on his forehead, a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of the claret velvet and breeches of brown doeskin. They fitted with never a wrinkle. His boots were up to the thigh, and he rode with a jewelled twinkle, his pistol butt a twinkle, his rapier hilt a twinkle under the jewelled sky. Over the cobbles he clattered and clashed in the dark inn yard. He tapped with his whip on the shutters, but all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window. Who should be waiting there but as the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And dark in the dark old inn yard, a stable wicket creaked, where Tim, the ostler, listened. His face was white and peaked. His eyes were hollows of madness, his hair like mouldy hay. But he loved the landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter. Dumb as a dog, he listened. He heard the robber say, "One kiss, my bonny sweetheart. I'm after a prize tonight, but I shall be back with the yellow gold before the morning light. Yes, if they press me sharply and harry me through the day, then look for me by moonlight. Watch for me by moonlight. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." He rose upright in the stirrups. He scarce could reach her hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burned like a brand, as the black cascade of perfume came tumbling over his breast, and he kissed its waves in the moonlight. Oh, sweet black waves in the moonlight. Then he tugged at his rein in the moonlight and galloped away to the west. He did not come in the dawning. He did not come at noon. And out of the tawny sunset, before the rise of the moon, when the road was a gypsy's ribbon looping the purple moor, a red-cope troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the old inn door. They said no word to the landlord. They drank his ale instead, and they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt at her casement, with muskets at their side. There was death at every window, and hell at one dark window. For Bess could see through her casement the road that he would ride. They'd tied her up to attention, with many a sniggering jest. They'd bound a musket beside her, with the muzzle beneath her breast. "Now keep good watch!" And they kissed her. She heard the doomed man say, "Look for me by moonlight, watch for me by moonlight. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." She twisted her hands behind her, but all the knots held good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat and blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness, and the hours crawled by like years. Till now, on the stroke of midnight, cold on the stroke of midnight, the tip of one finger touched it. The trigger at last was hers. The tip of one finger touched it. She strove no more for the rest. Up she stood to attention with the muzzle beneath her breast. She would not risk their hearing. She wouldn't strive again. For the road laid bare in the moonlight, blank and bare in the moonlight, and the blood of her veins in the moonlight throbbed to her love's refrain. Plot, 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 plot. And they heard it. The horse's hooves ringing clear. Plot, 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 plot in the distance. Were they deaf? They didn't hear. Down the ribbon of moonlight over the brow of the hill, the highwaymen came riding, riding, riding. The redcoats looked to their priming. She stood up, straight and still. Clot, clot! In the frosty silence, clot, clot! In the echoing night, nearer he came and nearer. Her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment. She drew one last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight. Her musket shattered the moonlight, shattered her breast in the moonlight, and warned him with her death. He turned. He spurred to the west. He didn't know who stood, bowed, with her head of the musket drenched with her own blood. Not till the dawn he heard it, and his face grew grey to hear how Bess, the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for her love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. Back he spurred like a madman, shouting a curse to the sky, with the white road smoking behind him and his rapier brandished high. Blood-red were his spurs in the golden noon, wine-red was his velvet coat, when they shot him down in the highway, down like a dog in the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway, with the bunch of lace at his throat. And still of a winter's night, they say, when the wind is in the trees, and the moon is a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas, when the road is a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, a highwayman comes riding, riding, riding. A highwayman comes riding up to the old inn door. Over the cobbles he clatters and clangs in the dark inn yard, and he taps with his whip on the shutters, but all is locked and barred. He whistles a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. Wow, this goes to show sinners can show heroic love too. Amen.
That's all from the English feature programme today and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.